This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 103.5.
Thursday evening, welcome to it now, the Business Report on Nova 103.5. And today we deal with unemployment. What does it mean? What can we do about it? What is the impact of unemployment? And what are our prospects for actually handling the scourge that affects so many Namibians? We'll be talking to Herbert Jauch in a short while, who offers his insights. Danny Mayer from SME Compete tells us about his life story and how he has spent most of it trying to deal with unemployment in the spotlight. Roland Brown joins us for the Market Watch and gives us his unique insights on from an economic perspective, and has some interesting things to say about there are some fairly simple things that can be done to deal with this. And then Job Muniaru, the Secretary General of the National Union of Namibian Workers, umbrella body for unions in Namibia, joins us and offers his insights from a labor perspective as to what should be done to deal with unemployment. And then, of course, Monique Landman-Bovenkamp offers us her unique insights onto the issue of unemployment and leadership and how leaders can be dealing with this slightly better. All of that and more in this evening's Business Report. But before we get into our lead story, let's start out with the Business Flash Briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of BizNews.
With your Biz News, I'm Charlize Maslengle. Namibia's mining production targets for 2023 are under threat from the continued rise in fuel prices. Chamber of Mines of Namibia has warned. This comes as the Ministry of Mines and Energy on Monday announced a $1.98 price hike in the diesel price to $24.10 per litre, with future increases forecasted. The unions representing South African public service workers have accused the government of using delaying tactics such as pleading poverty in the conciliation talks taking place at the Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council in Centurion, north of Johannesburg. An agreement between Emirates and South African Tourism Council has seen a significant increase in flights into and out of South Africa. Demand is at an all-time high, especially after the COVID-19 pandemic. The Federal Reserve delivered another steep interest rate increase on Wednesday as expected when its move to cool red-hot inflation taking on more weight amid the political milestone ahead of key U.S. midterm elections. I'm Charlize Maslengle. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Time now for the lead story on the Business Report, and this lead story proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
I'm speaking to local labor expert Herbert Jauch about the topic of unemployment. Hello, Mr. Jauch.
Hello.
How would you describe the current unemployment situation in the country?
In one word, I would say it's catastrophic. Sure. Because the last figures we have are now 4 years old, long before the COVID pandemic. At that time, it stood at 34% overall, close to 50% for young people. As I said, that was before COVID. Now we had this complete meltdown. And every year we have about 50, 60,000 young people entering the labor market from school, colleges, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in an economy that's contracting, or that was contracting and hardly growing, and which currently grows a little, largely through mining, which is not labor absorbing. That's a capital intensive industry. It means that the unemployment rate now must be substantially higher. I would guess 40-45% overall amongst young people, now over 50%. Now, when one puts that in a perspective for young people, that only every second one has a chance of finding a job. And many of these jobs are, of course, not great jobs, not decent work, not good jobs that allow you to meet your needs and raise a family on. That's why I say this scenario is, in my view, so underplayed in the public discourse because it is dramatic.
You're talking about that sort of catastrophic situation. So if you were given the chance, what recommendations would you make to the authorities to tackle unemployment? I mean, perhaps breaking your answer into two different categories, so general unemployment and youth unemployment, if there are different interventions, of course.
Yes. The one was I was involved with unions, employers, and government some years back to design national employment policies where we tried to tackle that systematically. And my view is there must be two key interventions. The one is absolute radical insistence on beneficiation of local products. Mm-hmm. And that ranges from agricultural goods to fishing products to minerals. And put an end to the kind of export of raw materials. Mm. And in some cases, mining might even be counterproductive. There is now the talk of new uranium mines in southern and eastern Namibia, mm. which would have a detrimental impact on agriculture. Now, when you compare jobs created in mining and jobs created through agriculture, mm. then you must say, well, we rather down-tune mining and create more jobs in other sectors. Secondly, create jobs around value chains for goods that are needed in the country. And what comes to mind there are the officially 300,000 housing units that we are lacking. Now, if you create a whole industry and value chains and supply chains around housing, it's not only bricks and cement, it's all kinds of other materials. You can have young people specifically trained for that industry. And you know there's a need for decades to come to tackle the housing backlog, to get people out of shacks. Countries like Singapore have done that. And it needs a kind of a developmental state intervention to say this is a clear area where we need it. And the third area, which we've seen in the COVID pandemic strongly, is universal health care for all. Mm. You have to invest in good health care for all alongside education. And then if we have housing and sanitation as well, then you have areas where you improve standards of living significantly, but at the same time, you can create a large number of jobs. So I would start thinking that reducing imports into Namibia where we can produce locally. And one good example, a successful one, is fresh produce. Mm. We tended to import almost all fresh produce from South Africa. And then the Agri Board set a quota. It's now about 40%, that shops must source 40% of their fresh produce locally. So all of a sudden, you have kind of green schemes emerging or the hard-up scheme, etc., and they know they have a ready-made market. Now, that quota can be increased, and it will immediately create jobs. So these are the kind of interventions that are very practical, that are very doable right now. Medium term, we need to look at the structure of our economy because we have hardly any manufacturing in Namibia. And we need to look how we move away from the reliance on primary industries to create these number of jobs. And with a population of 2.5 million people, that should simply be possible. If we focus on our resources, on their beneficiation, on value chains around housing and other concrete needs, it should be possible. And that would be my advice.
It sounds like the idea is then a lot of smaller scale operations rather than sort of these big projects. I read an article the other day about public works, these massive public works projects, which are always seen to be huge employers and generators. But the article was saying that that's not actually the case. Would you agree with that?
Yes. The Big Bang project. Mm. And we had also involving foreign companies like Ramatex, where there was this talk of 10,000-20,000 jobs being created through that industry alone. And we ended up with 4,000 horribly poorly paid jobs for a certain period of time, and then they moved on. So the kind of hope of Big Bang solutions in a country like Namibia, I think, is misplaced. Mm. And I think we need to learn the lesson. If you have decentralized housing initiatives, often driven by self-help group like the Shack Dwellers Federation, then around such initiatives, you will have a range of smaller businesses emerging, supplying that kind of chain. Mm. And I think with our relatively large space over which a small population is distributed, we also, in terms of energy creation, we need to think of decentralized, probably solar-driven energy, and then also those with technical skills coming from universities or other institutions can then find work there in maintaining that system, and we become kind of energy self-sufficient on renewables. These are things that are possible, and I think this is the kind of thinking we need to adopt away from the Big Bang solution, but rather looking at a variety of interventions, small to medium size in most cases, but that can then be sustained at that level.
Something else that I'm picking up is a sort of an emphasis on skills. And I suppose if we're talking about smaller scale operations, presumably more technical skills. For a while, obviously, we did away with technical colleges. We are coming back with TVETs. But would you say that skills are possibly more important than qualifications going forward?
We need definitely both. And it was unfortunate that we've gone virtually one way towards promoting academic qualifications only. And the former education minister once described vocational training for those who don't do well at school. He almost implied, look, the failures can still go to VET. They don't need to have grade 12. Now, that labeled a whole generation of young people. It de-emphasized not only the training, but also devalued it. Kind of, these are the people who are really of secondary importance. Mm. That was extremely short-sighted, and it was a reflection on the minister's understanding of skills and qualification and education in general. Now, my view is that we need to have the best possible broad-based education as a foundation that will allow people then to specialize, be it in the technical field and vocational training, be it in the academic field, or a mixture of both. Because economies and their need as they develop, they change. Mm. It's not that one set of skills is required and now we know for the next 20 years we are fine with it. It changes all the time. So, for example, when you move towards a process of beneficiation of local raw materials, in the process you will need a whole range of technologies and skills that go with it as you use. When you, for example, would at some point produce panel housing in Namibia as one option for housing construction. You would not only need the machines to produce the panel, but also the technical skills of how to use it. And from the employer side, it is for me a bit astonishing that we hear for 20, 30 years about the skills gap in Namibia. Mm. Then the training levy is instituted with a view of enabling companies to use that money and that support to fill the skills gap. And we learn that only a small percentage of employers are actually using it. So
the president recently made a statement that the reason we have such high employment is that we are creating too many graduates. Do you agree with that statement?
I don't know where the president gets onto that. It's almost saying if we didn't create the graduates, they would have jobs. Now, people without degrees are also unemployed. In fact, when you look at the ratio, people with degrees, how many of them are unemployed, and people without degrees, those without have still a higher rate of unemployment. So just based on facts, I don't know where the president comes to that. What he maybe wanted to imply was we place too great emphasis on just academic qualifications that the labor market cannot absorb. But now you need to look at that labor market. Why is it so stagnant? Why can it not absorb people with tertiary qualifications? And there we come to the question that we're still largely an exporter of raw materials, that we have hardly a manufacturing industry, that research and development is happening at a low pace in Namibia. So people with higher skills find it difficult to work. And some are leaving the country already because their skills are sought elsewhere, but not inside Namibia. So the president needs to look at that and not blame people for gaining university degrees or technical skills or become graduates. That's not the reason why people are unemployed.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Yach.
You're welcome.
That's this evening's lead story. And it was proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 1035. Namibia's business leader on Novo 1035.
Welcome back to the Business Report on Nova 1035. Time now for our spotlight feature. And as every week, we find interesting, prominent, or just weird Namibians who are doing great work for the economy, for the community, or for the world. I guess today's guest gets covered by a lot of those. Danny Meyer, founder and director at SME Compete. Danny, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Gary, and good day to all the listeners out there.
So, Danny, let's start at the very beginning. You're a child of Southern Africa, born in SA, spent a lot of time in Zimbabwe, and now also been in Namibia for nearly 3 decades. Tell us a little bit about your travels and how your family got to move around the continent.
Well, I'm in the baby boomer generation, so our parents had many kids. Grew up with not much, we grew up in the time where you had to make your own toys and your own games, and I guess that even set me on my entrepreneurial journey, because my mother, and she played a very important part. Entrepreneurs, actually, maternal figures, very important for them. She says that from a young age already, I would make things and sell it to younger and older siblings and so on. And I also learned from her servant leadership, actually, and doing good things. If you give, your hand is outstretched, then you will receive as well. And so that's what's guided me on my journey, whether it be entrepreneurship, businesses I've started, businesses I've helped others start, and the way I go about conducting my business.
So what we often see being paralleled, certainly from a South African context, is Zimbabwe's almost a foreshadow of what everybody fears. You spent a lot of time in what would have been Rhodesia back then, and would have watched the transition to some extent and would have been interested in that as well. And, of course, for those first 10 years, Zimbabwe was the darling of the international market. Are those parallels justified given your own personal experience?
Well, I think they serve as learning lessons. There are amber lights that flash every now and again. My wife and I talk about it and say, wow, please don't go down this route. So there are concerns. Yes, as a youngster, I believed that the country could really become the Singapore of Africa those days, and it was on the right path. But unfortunately, of course, then when you live beyond your means, whether it be as a country, as an individual, as a business, you are going to pay the price. And so while the times may be good, one should set aside a little bit for the lean times, and I think that's what went wrong. And then starts finger pointing, and you know, you have and we don't have, and so on and so forth, instead of actually uniting as a nation and say, come on, we've made some errors here. We see a creeping poverty. We need to do things differently. So, yes, I have experienced that, not only in the countries where I've had the pleasure of living and working, but also beyond that. I spent a lot of time doing business. I got involved in the business sector representative body in countries like Tanzania, Malawi, Kenya, Zambia, and even in West Africa. And I saw there that this huge potential is unfortunately being squandered, because often politicians and technocrats don't see the big picture. And if we could do things just slightly differently, make the economy run a lot better, we would solve a lot of these problems, the growing joblessness and so forth. And that, yes, you're right, Gary. That sometimes I see the amber lights, not only here, but all over the continent, saying, wow, guys, we've seen that doesn't work. Do we really want to go down that route again?
I'm always interested in people's educational paths, especially those who've contributed. So tell us a little bit about high school and universities.
Yeah, I excelled in primary school, actually, and made up my mind I was actually going to be a doctor. I must say that I guess the entrepreneurship pull got a bit stronger in high school, and I found it boring, actually. I found it boring. I didn't go straight to university. I actually went as a mature student. So obviously, my mother and even siblings were disappointed, but I said, no, let me go out there into the world, gain that life experience, and I will go back and study, and I did that. And strangely, I did the same with my wife as well, and I had to do a bit of bullying there and say to her, you need to go and get some qualification. What if something happens to me? This world requires some sort of paper, a piece of paper as well. And she also excelled, actually. So I have a lot of empathy for those school dropouts, because I know that that's not going to be the end of their educational journey. And I think we need to do a lot more on adult education. And that's why I throw my heart and soul. I always said that I wanted to come across and share my entrepreneurial experience. And I put my heart and soul into developing skills programs. That's what really, figuratively speaking, Gary, blows my hair back.
Okay. Well, that's done a good job at that, Danny.
Yeah.
I just want to focus back on your educational experience. Did you find, as a mature student, and how mature were you?
Well, I already had several kids, and right, I was sitting with lecturers who I fondly think of them, Jamson Karasha, and others, who said to me, Danny, you're actually teaching us. So it was a lovely experience. You had lecturers who often were actually younger than me.
All right. So how much impact, going back as a mature student, did tertiary education have on either your thinking or kind of how you saw the world at that point?
Probably more supplementary than such a great impact. I think that there's a disconnect between educational institutions and the real world of business. I worked very hard at that when I got involved in the Chamber of Commerce, National Chamber of Commerce in Zimbabwe and in local government. Said, guys, let's try and pull closer. And it actually worked. Put in programs starting already in the first years of high school, school on the shop floor, work experience, not only for the learners, but for the teachers too. And I see it. The graduates who come out of tertiary educational institutions in Namibia, really, one needs to spend a lot of time showing them what really happens in the world of economics or accountancy or human resources and so on. And so there is a bit of a disconnect. And I think that's one of the issues that need to be tackled with renewed vigor in Namibia, in addition, of course, to making the business environment more conducive.
So business, you can tackle that for a second and just perhaps shortly your thoughts on if I provided a statement, it's clear there's a disconnect between tertiary institutions and practical application of much of the knowledge that the world requires. Is there therefore still value in tertiary education for people wanting to forge a path in commerce?
Probably more as employees than employers. I like some of the distance programs that I've seen coming up, entrepreneurship programs and so on, because it is important for entrepreneurs. And entrepreneurs are notoriously slack when it comes to the administration, the paperwork and so on. And so it is for them to understand there are compliance issues, statutory requirements. So it's good in that sense. But there has to be an overall of these programs, entrepreneurship and so on. And Gary, it's not just at universities. I'm also talking about vocational training centers. We've seen with the offtake, the artisan program offtake, which is being run by the Development Bank of Namibia, how they might be a good panel beater or a spray painter or motor mechanic or plumber or electrician. But just actually starting their little business, the skills lack there in terms of bookkeeping, record keeping, putting systems in place in your business, that is missing. So it clearly manifests itself over and over again, that disconnect. And the tertiary educational institutions really need to start taking that serious and work with the business sector representative bodies to see how that can be filled. And we see it happening in the tourism and hospitality sector, and there's some wonderful tertiary work being done and skills development and so on. But it needs to go right across the board, whether it's in logistics, manufacturing, commerce, trading, professions, artisans and so on.
All right, so let's step back from policy now. We want to talk about Danny. You arrived in Namibia just after independence. You would have been a young man. You would have been filled with idealism, a country just released. Tell us a little bit about your experience over the last few decades in Namibia and how you've, you know, what you've perceived over this time.
Okay, when I arrived, it was on an LSD. I was on an LSD trip. Look, see, and discover. Okay. Don't get that wrong, LSD. So I then looked at and then came back a few times, saw the fledgling stock exchange, saw investment opportunities, and I actually backed that. I was surprised that more Namibians were not into that. And then I was invited actually to come back here and work with restructuring the business sector representative body, the main one in the country. And from there, I was, I guess, headhunted, one could say, to work on a program to bring an entrepreneurial dimension to a program that was going to support small and medium enterprises. And when that ended, I said to Namibian partners. This is what is really needed. And the person who was so supportive was the late Lazarus Mpangewa, who had then been appointed as the first Namibian chief executive of the of one of the commercial banks. He'd come from the central bank to a commercial bank. And he felt, and I said, grass grows from the roots. There's a great deal of importance on foreign direct investment, but it should not be done ignoring the importance of domestic investment. And so we need to start. We've seen iconic black entrepreneurs in the country have come through the informal sector. And so I said, that's where the focus should be. We should see how we can work with helping the informal sector, which contributes over a quarter of Namibia's GDP at the moment, migrate into the formal sector. And so that's what happened. And we started that SME Compete journey. People said, you wouldn't last for 2 years. Your business model is wrong. And here we are. We have, at any time, about 2,000 entrepreneurs around the country, from Impalila Island down to Carisburg, which we service. When they get big enough, they have to move out. And it's lovely when I read in the print media or hear interviews on one of your radio stations where there's an entrepreneur who's doing so well and you're spotlighting. And I always tell my colleagues, you know what? We actually help them. And that's where the satisfaction comes. But Gary, let me just conclude by saying that I still have business interests. So this is my payback. I've always said that if I am going to be successful in business, I should put something back. And so there gets to a point in time where you, as part of your succession and exit plan, want to do something. And that's what I do. And I just love working with entrepreneurs all over Namibia, whether it's in Carisburg, in Omakangi, in Sandi. I've been so fortunate. I've visited literally every town. And I work right at the front line of entrepreneurship.
Right. We're going to dig into some of the challenges you face when we come back. But now we have a treat for our listeners. We've asked you to just select a song. Just tell us very shortly what you select.
Now, when I'm driving in Namibia, and especially over the 2 years of lockdown, when I was involved in a major grant program for small businesses around the country, I would listen to music. And the one that I've enjoyed from the very first time I ever heard it, which was many decades ago, is Eve of Destruction, Barry Maguire. And it sounds a bit harsh. I think the listeners might catch a bit of a skrik there, but it's as relevant today as it was 57 years ago when that song first hit the charts.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war. But what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. My blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation. And marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe.
is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace and tell me.
Eve of Destruction from Barry Maguire, light little happy tune. The choice of Danny Meyer, the founder and director at SME Compete, who's in the spotlight this evening. Danny, tell us a little bit about, you know, SMEs has been a catchphrase for politicians for many decades. We see it being touted as the cure for unemployment, the cure for economic growth, the cure for the future. But SMEs face quite a few unique challenges, especially when we think about startup and then obviously those first vital few years of growth as the business starts to take hold. Tell us a little bit about SME Compete and why you guys exist.
Okay, so Gary, startups you mentioned, actually there are many programs for them. Startups can usually access a little bit of funding, not much to get going. I think the programs are not always well structured in the sense that many who are benefiting from that actually have no interest in ever starting a business. They just want a job. They can't get a job because of the high joblessness in the country. So SME Compete was specifically started to help those who are already in business to become the wind under their wings. Now, that doesn't mean we don't work with startups. We will have group programs and so on, and they're most welcome. But our focus, and especially on our mentorship program, business linkages and so on, were those who are already in business. They don't have to be in formal business, but our criteria is you should at least be in business for a year.
So give us an idea of your average customer. What sort of business does he have?
Actually, a high proportion of them are females. Women actually are very good at doing business, I guess, because the principles that are required are like money discipline, being frugal, being focused,
being
and
nice
so on.
To customers.
Yeah, and guys tend to get distracted easy, shall we say? So the typical client could be, and I'm going to use this example. She was a Kapana lady. And I met her many decades ago, and Paulina Pietras is her name, and I'm sure she won't mind me mentioning it. She told me that she could not grow her business because she couldn't get stock. I did a bit of basic bookkeeping training because I said, if you can't record it down, you're not going to know how your business is actually doing. And she came afterwards and spoke to me. And I helped her strategize to get more supplies from her supplier by way of reverse psychology. So I said, if that person is rude to you, be nice to them. And it actually worked. And from there onwards, she saw an opportunity. Her husband was in building construction. He was just a semi-skilled worker. And he couldn't go to work because there was a shortage of bricks. And she said, but we can make those. And he said, no, we can't. And she said, yes, we can. I saw a little mold at one of the hardware stores. And from there she went. And she actually grew a business from being a Kapana lady to then supplying meat to other Kapana ladies to completely diversifying into brick making, first blocks, then bricks, then interlocks. And she ended up with a workforce of 60 plus people. Now, she had never gone beyond primary school. She never had the opportunity. But she knew the principles. So she employed people in the community who were hard of hearing, deaf. And she said, you know, I see these people in the community, they can't get jobs. So there was this real entrepreneurship shining through, the social side, because entrepreneurs, that's a characteristic of them. And so the other one is a lady from Ondangwa. She started making the clothing, you know, the traditional garments and so on. And then she saw an opportunity. She saw on television, these gospel choirs. They have like graduation type of gowns. And she started saying, wow, the choir. So she started making then she started making graduation gowns for tertiary educational institutions. Then she started exporting them to Botswana. So Gary, what happens if you can work with those in the informal sector, you're going to spot very quickly the stars. You then help them put structures in place. You mentor them. Business mentorship is very important. And then from there, you position them and they'll grow. And I can spend hours just talking about success stories from all over Namibia. So Namibia has entrepreneurs. You just need to go to every town, village. There's a little marketplace. And we need to somehow find how can we put the wind under their wings to lift them. And maybe out of every 100, it'll only be 10. If we're lucky, probably 5. But if each 5 of those will employ 2 people and then becomes 5 people, 10 people, that's where the problem lies. We have this urban migration, people coming to Windhoek looking for jobs, which aren't there. It puts pressure on the infrastructure and so on. We need to help people create jobs right in their communities.
Where they already are.
And that's what our focus is. That's why we tend to work with those who are already in business. Discipline is very important. We operate as a private entity, although there's movements towards an NGO type of operation as part of the succession planning for my Namibian colleagues who will stay, to actually focus on getting that working well. So yeah, we're known to be the go-to place. We'll help you register your business. We'll help you put the paperwork in place to employ people, employment contracts and so on, because we know you don't have the funds to go to a legal professional. You will later on. And as we say to banks, we're helping these entrepreneurs to become your future bankable clients. So that is the aim, because we know in a security-based environment, it's difficult for you if they can't provide collateral to give them a loan. But we're going to help them build up their asset base, show that they can keep books and so on. And so it's a journey. It's a long-term journey, and I've really enjoyed it. I've loved, working in Namibia. Namibia has got so much potential. This economy can gain traction very quickly, and jobs can literally be created overnight.
All right, so let's touch on that, Danny. And you spoke about discipline, so I'm going to have to ask you to condense your answer here as far as you can. So I'm going to limit you in your answer.
Okay.
I'd like you to pick one thing that our theme of this week's show is unemployment and tackling and addressing the scourge of unemployment. What's the one thing that the Namibian government or Namibian business should be focusing on in their attempts to address this?
I believe the grants, small grants to help the carpenter get their tools, their equipment, which they're currently using a handsaw to scale up production from making basic tables, chairs, and beds for shack dwellers to scale up and actually start making domestic furniture. I think agriculture sector is actually the low-hanging fruit. I believe that a lot more emphasis should be played. We've seen how small-scale farmers, market gardeners can quickly create jobs and in turn also generate income for themselves, wealth creation and job creation. So that's the short answer. Danny's not a short answer person, unfortunately.
All right. So let's now turn to the future. You're contemplating a different phase in your life.
Yeah.
And perhaps scaling back a little bit on some of your current responsibilities and looking forward to some others. What is your dream for an organization like SME Compete? Where would you like to be sitting in your armchair in 15 or 20 years' time and see the organization and sort of smile knowing you did that?
Gary, we've got a wonderful team, and I have made it a point over the years to bring in interns. from tertiary educational institutions, graduates, undergraduates, school dropouts as well. And they're all over the country. I think the number now exceeds 55, could be around about 50, 56, 57. And they're in very good positions around the country. They also become our ambassadors. And I've said to my colleagues, you're going to continue with this because the work with entrepreneurship and enterprise, developing enterprise culture in Namibia is long from over. The country is so well positioned to service and become a beacon in the region. So that's still going to continue, but you need ambassadors out there. You need somebody that you can pick up the phone who will now be in a decision-making position and say, hey, I need a facility in Ongenga. I'm coming to do a program there. And we work on the basis of being frugal at all times. So we got to also, we got to not only teach and preach, but we got to live by that. So my dream is that I've made it known that I would like to exit by the end of 24. This is coming towards the end of the journey. I've got another 2 years. I believe my Namibian colleagues are ready. They've taken over many facets. And I would like to replicate this one in one other country in Southern Africa. I have been asked by two countries, Lesotho and Zambia, to come and replicate this model. So I need to now start engaging earnestly with potential partners there, help them set it up. We've got an excellent array of programs and so on, tried and tested. They can be customized. And so that will be what I'm going to do, Gary. Harold Papkowitz, entrepreneurs don't retire. Harold, went to work and sadly the same day later passed away, but he was moving close to a century. I'm not sure if I'm going to be blessed with that, but I would certainly like to work and share as long as I can. And I've done that with all my business interests. I've involved locals. One doesn't start a business to close it down. You start a business and put a succession plan in, and it should be there forever and a day. And so that's what I'm going to do now. I want to take a longish break to go and do a little bit of traveling. I need to go and see friends. I have friends from Uganda, Rwanda, Tanzania, and so on. So I want to take a couple of months off to go and do journey up the continent. And I'll also then focus more earnestly on the successor to SME Compete Namibia that started right here in Namibia to help Namibians on the way up. I want to replicate that in either one of those other countries. I mentioned the Kingdom of Lesotho or the lovely country of Zambia.
Danny Meyer, thank you so much for joining us in the spotlight this evening. And thank you for all of your efforts, your passion, your hard work and energy that you put into helping Namibia to grow at a very critical part of its economic cycle, where often government policy doesn't sort things out, but skills transfers, coaching, training, and more importantly, encouragement is what gets small businesses over the line. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And keep up your good work. Thank you.
Thank you, Danny. Danny, founder and director of SME Compete, in this evening's spotlight.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
The BizNews Ramp is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors. M&Z Motors is proud to introduce the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Contact M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group today for your test drive or visit the M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group Facebook page and check out their great offers. Jeep, go anywhere, do anything.
Welcome back to the Business Report. You're on Nova 103.5. Time now for our Market Watch and the theme of this week's show, the scourge of unemployment. I'm joined in the studio this evening by Roland Brown from Cirrus Capital. Roland, welcome back to the Business Report. Unemployment. Let's start out by just firstly trying to understand, what does that mean? We often see numbers being touted. We understand that there's different, there's functional unemployment, there's different definitions of it. Just take us through how economists view unemployment.
Well, like you say, there's lots of ways to look at it, but I think the most common way is willing and able people that are of working age that are would like to be members of the employed population in essence and are or are not. So you have a labor force, which is willing and able persons that are of working age, and then the percent of that group that is that has some form of gainful employment. In Namibia specifically, and in the region and globally to some extent, we look at strict and broad definitions of employment. I think it's quite, generally speaking, you don't have huge differences between those numbers around most of the world. But in this part of the world, you do have often very large differences between those numbers. So basically, to be employed in the strict definition, you need to, this is a very sort of lay way of explaining it, but you need to have, in essence, a sort of cash income. And in the broad sense, you basically need to have some kind of cash or in-kind income. And in Namibia specifically, the survey question that determines whether you're employed is, have you worked for cash or in-kind income in the last week for more than an hour? So the bar is set extremely low to be classified as employed. And then within that definition of employment, then you capture all sorts of things like subsistence farmers. You capture things like a family member that does nannying work in exchange for a couple of plates of food or something like that. So the bar is set very low here.
Okay. And despite that, the numbers are pretty frightening. Give us an idea of the state of unemployment in Namibia.
Well, we don't know. I think that's actually more frightening. Namibia hasn't done a labor force survey since 2018. And that's actually one of the more recent surveys that we have when it comes to socioeconomic data. So we haven't done a census. We did an intercensinal survey in 2016, but we haven't done a census in more than a decade. We're supposed to do every decade. We haven't done a household income and expenditure survey since 2015-16. And as mentioned, we haven't done a labor force survey since 2018, sorry. So we really have very little idea of what's going on. And obviously the world has changed quite a bit since 2018, and Namibia has changed quite a bit since 2018. And this lack of data, I mean, there's been just this remarkable change in how frequently data has become available over the last 5 or so years. When the statistics agency was spun out of the CBS, the Central Bureau of Statistics at the National Planning Commission, and it became an SOE, then when Dr. Stately was running that, we had vast amounts of data being produced on a regular basis. And just over the last few years, it's gone off a cliff. That's largely budget related. There's just not money being allocated to this, but there's a lot of other problems as well. And I think that there's also a distinct lack of innovation when it comes to finding cheaper ways of collecting data that can at least be used as proxies for these sorts of things. So really, we don't know what's the state of unemployment is. The last info we have, that 2018 info, 33.4% of the population was unemployed. Now, that's pre-COVID, and there's certainly been both a deterioration in the quality of employment and the quantum of employment subsequent to that. But we don't know exactly how much it is. What we do know is that there have been material retrenchments. So this data is collected by the Ministry of Labor. So we know that particularly through COVID, there was a lot of kind of restructuring of employment. So many organizations that, you know, were perhaps outdated from a employment structure perspective or from an HR perspective, kind of restructured. And then there were also a lot of business closures and downscaling and things like that through COVID. So we're very confident that there's been a big increase in unemployment and a decrease in the quality of employment. But the quantum, the exact quantum, is very difficult to put your finger on.
Okay. Well, you raised two important points there. One that we don't know, which is, of course, pretty chilling because you can't solve a problem unless you understand it. But secondly, speculation as to if the data is bad, do you even want people to see it? Might be a little bit of strategy, which is chilling. We do have looked at South Africa, which often, you know, there's correlation. And a chilling number that came out of the latest set of data that was a month or two ago, 76% unemployment in the age bracket 18 to 35. And of course, this is, when you're 65 and unemployed, it's not as big an issue as when you're 18 and unemployed, given the amount of time that runs. And if we assume the same sort of ratio, because we have the same sort of population pyramid, we've actually got a ticking time bomb with unemployment, in that many young people have been unemployed for a long period of time, yep, and have almost no prospect of ever being employed. And that seems to be something that we're not really sort of bringing into the equation.
Yeah, so we have a very, very high degree of structural unemployment, and it's which is this long-term sustained unemployment. It's not that it's a flash in the pan because of COVID. Mm. There are very few places in the world that can sustain, you know, levels of unemployment of 30% plus for any period of time without major political realignment or socioeconomic or social unrest and so on. And it's been a question that we've sort of grappled with for a long time of why and how we have got away with that in Namibia. In South Africa, for example, you see much, much higher degrees of social unrest and much, much more obvious changes in political alignment of the population. In Namibia, we know that the young population, so that sort of age group, there's different classifications, but that the youth population, and I'm not talking like SWAPO youth, I'm talking like 30 or under kind of age, that population, at least half of that population is unemployed. Probably now closer to 70%, 60 to 70%. But certainly at least half is unemployed. This is the most important voter group now as well. If you just look at the demographics of the country, about 65% of the population will fall into, 65 of the voting age population will fall into that bracket as well. And that means, that should mean a lot when it comes to political behavior. And I think we did actually see a change in political behavior between 2014 and 2019 when particularly this young aspirational voter group that's just been, you know, really left behind and feels that political incumbents don't really do much for them started to vote quite differently. And in 2020, then in the local authority elections, we saw a kind of re-engaging of a disenfranchised voter group that had been kind of non-politically active following the 2019 results that was such a surprise. And I think we'd be very naive to think that there won't be more changes in the next few years.
All right. So, I mean, I think it's safe to say there's a problem. It's big. It's getting bigger. And then there's no natural conclusion to it on the horizon. So then we must turn to perhaps some of the mitigation strategies, things like government policy, organic growth of the economy. There's some bright lights on the horizon. With energy being now and tourism returning and energy being the thing that comes and saves us. But let's perhaps break it down a little bit. Let's first turn our attention to government policy. Perhaps give us a sense of your thoughts on where's the low-hanging fruit? Where are things that we could do relatively easily at not huge expense without massive regulatory upheaval to address this issue of unemployment?
So I think one has to almost take a step further back on that and say, you know, how can we sort of redefine this problem in a way that illustrates the cause of the problem rather than the outcome of the problem? And I think that's something that we seem to be a little bit cautious of doing for some reason that I don't fully comprehend as a nation. So we sort of redefine this problem to say Namibia has a crisis of employers, and that results in a crisis of unemployment. The crisis of employers, I think, is very much the root or the proximate cause of this unemployment issue. How can it be the case that we have thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that need jobs and so few job creators, and yet we don't go to that job creator issue and say, well, you know, where are these jobs going to come from and why are there so few job creators? And I think that that's actually a very fundamental problem. And to define the problem in that manner, I think gets you one step closer to the solutions. So in my mind, we have a crisis of employers. And I think often when we look at solutions to that crisis of employers, we look to sort of big, silver bullet type solutions. And, you know, oil and green hydrogen and things like this are sometimes painted as these solutions that are going to materially change the country. But for a vast or a large portion of the population, they'll do very little, unless we're very strategic on policy. And I think when it comes to employment and this crisis of employers, we need to understand the labor force. The Namibian labor force is made up predominantly of grade 10 top level of education. And to think that you're going to go into these hyper-modern technologies like green hydrogen and create jobs for people that haven't, you know, got that degree of education, that are going to be reasonable quality jobs and things like that, you know, that's a bit of a stretch of the imagination, I think. And you know, if you then, and so you need to sort of take that into account when it comes to this crisis of job creators and look at the type of job creators that we need. And I think that that's very important when we start talking about this stuff, because these meta these mega projects, these silver bullet solutions don't really cater to the type of employment that we need to be creating in the country. In general, as well as that, I don't believe at all in this idea that we must pick sectors and things like that. I think even if you have, you know, 10 extremely smart people in a room, they're not going to come up with a fraction of the possibilities. And most of the time, those extremely smart people are looking at where innovators have done innovative things and then trying to follow on. So we see things like government is big on, you know, biomass policy, well, or biomass projects, and therefore backing biomass or putting in place biomass policies and incentives. Well, that's not something that was grown. The biomass opportunities haven't been grown out of government initiative, but subsequently they're being supported. The same on various agricultural things. You know, these blueberries in the north, for example. Now, that's an innovator, an entrepreneur that's come up with that, is implementing it, and now government's sort of following with policy. And I don't think that picking these winners in that sense is ever very effective from that central point. I think you have to just make it much easier for anyone that has a good idea to implement that idea, to try to generate some income out of it, to try to create some opportunities for themselves.
So what are those triggers? What are those things, in as simple language as you can muster, what are the things we should be doing in the short term to make sure that what you're saying becomes possible?
So I think that something that's very poorly understood often is that the regulatory burden, small regulatory things that appear, it's almost banal to talk of them, but that appear, you know, these really minor little things, they have a disproportionately large burden on small businesses, on, you know, one-man band, you know, people employing five others, etc. And I think because that's so poorly understood, and because that that group that run these small businesses doesn't have a seat at the table when we're talking to, you know, talking about the policy environment, that group is you know, not represented in the same way that the banks, that O&L, that, you know, the big companies around the country are. And those bigger entities, they don't feel that bureaucratic burden in the same way that these smaller entities do. So this is really basic stuff, like a small operator that needs to get an environmental clearance certificate and needs to put a whole lot of information together in order to do that. A small operator that needs to get licenses, or needs to register for tax, or needs to get, you know, any of these kind of basic processes can be very expensive if, you know, you have no buffers, you have to leave a job in order to go and pursue them, etc. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing, and I think probably the single biggest issue, is our VAT and tax regime generally. VAT especially is an absolute killer for small businesses. And we, you know, a 500,000 turnover threshold is extremely low, actually. You know, many people, if you're trading, if you're buying goods and selling them, you're making almost no profit, but your turnover is in excess of 500,000. As soon as you have a VAT claim, it doesn't matter whether you're the biggest oil company in the country or if you're a small guy. We're sitting with VAT claims now that date back, I think, to January. And, you know, it's just, it's crippling for small businesses. Right. It's cash that disappears from your business. The other thing is trying to sort of milk the fruit off a tree while it's in its infancy. You know, it makes absolutely no sense to try to get maximum yield from a business while it's a tiny little sapling of a thing. You need to let it grow. You need to support it in growth. And our corporate tax regime, this very one-dimensional corporate tax regime, where it doesn't matter whether you're a tiny business with three people or you're a big business with 3,000 people, you're subject to the same tax regime. That makes it really difficult to start and grow and develop small businesses. There are definitely other issues. There's issues around access to finance, for sure. There's issues around access to market, access to expertise, and so on. But I think those are things that entrepreneurs can often overcome themselves, and that the private sector, that private businesses can assist entrepreneurs to overcome. But this business of the tax and just general bureaucracy regimes, I think that's really crippling for small businesses. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have aggressive tax regimes for big established businesses. I'm not at all opposed to that in principle. But for small businesses, you just cannot apply the same rules to, you know, Pete's welding shop that you apply to Old Mutual. It just doesn't make sense.
Okay. We're nearly out of time. So perhaps we end this chat with bright lights. Is there something coming down or happening or things we see evolving over the next little while that will help us in this aim to eliminate unemployment as much as we can?
So I think, interestingly, in Namibia, I think the policy environment has maybe turned a corner a little bit and is starting to improve a little bit, having been on a very, very steep descent between, say, 2014 and probably 2018 or so, 2019. I think there has definitely been a turnaround in the introduction of some technocrats into senior positions and just beefing up and strengthening some of the key ministries and so on, I think is definitely doing some good when it comes to turning the corner on the policy environment generally and sort of halting the slide. But there's a long way to go. And one of our major concerns around this is that there's so much focus going into these mega projects, into these oil and gas and hydrogen and things like that. There's so much energy going into looking for foreign investment, which is a good thing for sure. But there's just not that energy going into the grassroots businesses in Namibia. And that's really where this employment situation will be turned around. And that energy really has to go into that space. And what's nice about it is it's not necessarily a case initially of government doing a lot more. It's actually saying, look, we don't want to interfere until you're kind of this high. And at some point we will, you know, I think then one can start to go from that to looking at, okay, how do we actually foster and support and develop and help small businesses through action as opposed to just getting out of the way. So I think, yes, in general, the environment is improving, but for these small businesses that are going to create that grassroots employment, there's still a heck of a lot to do.
Roland Brown, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your thoughts. Roland Brown is Mother's favorite economist, founder and director at Cirrus Capital. That is it for this evening's Market Watch.
The BizNews Ramp is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Book your test drive today at MNZ Motors.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 103.5.
This week on the Business Report on Novo 103.5, we are talking unemployment, the scourge often of Africa and certainly one of the major barriers to economic growth, but also to civil society and to peacefulness and stability in Namibia. Namibia is among the countries with a high unemployment rate, particularly among the youth graduates roaming the streets with degrees. And of course, that's enormously worrying, as we often be telling young people, as long as you're studied and educated, you'll get a job. And that hasn't turned out to be the case for many people. It's expected that the unemployment rate to reach 49% by the end of this year. That's functional unemployment. We're now joined by the Secretary General of the National Union of Namibian Workers, Job Munwaru. Job, welcome to the Business Report.
Thank you.
So, Job, let's start at the beginning. What is the National Union of Namibian Workers' take on unemployment in the country?
Thank you very much. It's quite a very interesting and a very provocative interview, not in a sense of making someone angry, but in a sense of reality in terms of life. You see, Namibia as a country, I specifically regard Namibia as one of the richest countries. Looking into minerals and products that Namibia has, looking into the population that we have and the unemployment rate that we have, that does not correlate with the wealth of the country. And that's not what one expects to have as a leader. First of all, we want to see how can we stimulate employment. The only things that can help us with that is education systems. Speaking from your question saying graduates lying on the streets, it might not be the issue of graduation. It might be the issue of the curriculum that produce people that are not absorbable by the market. If you have a graduate with master's degrees and other things, and the market cannot absorb this person, then it tells you already that the curriculum somewhere is wrong. Because if the curriculum was not wrong, these people could have been directly been employed. So we need to revise our curriculums.
We had an entrepreneur in here last week who's into clothes manufacturing. And what he said was they had produced garments. They had a small factory that produced high-quality garments. They received two tentative orders from big retailers in South Africa, but they wanted 1 million units. But there was no scale on less than 1 million units. And to go from 100 units to 1 million units, as you can imagine, requires heavily intensive capital. So to your example of a carpentry, they might be producing great furniture, but they're unable to produce 10,000 chairs. They can perhaps produce 500 chairs. And the difference between 500 and 10,000 chairs, for example, is enormous. It's exponential.
I don't believe in someone's dreams. Before exports and importation was been done in this country, things were done here, and everybody knows what the chair is. We were not told to sit on a chair by the Western. We have been producing these things. I'm just deprived not to produce 10,000 instead of 500 because I'm deprived of my clients because of the middlemen and the people who wants to think only the registered companies can sell how much.
Right.
Why would the men on the street produce 10,000 shares if they are not marketed? They are not assisted to be marketed.
Okay.
If government and everybody in this country, every Namibian decides from today on we are going to sit on Namibian furnitures, these guys will be able to work 24 hours and produce 10,000. But if you go just once in a year to go and buy a souvenir for someone there and you don't buy for every Namibian, then you deprive yourself as a Namibian.
So let me perhaps shift the discussion a little bit.
Shift to any direction.
Thank you. Let's shift to the unions. What role do the unions play in helping to grow an economy?
You see, some of those things is facts. You can't be an employer without a worker. You can't make profits. You can't become rich if somebody is not making you rich. It does not work for you. The workers is the backbone of this economy, whether you like it or not. So it's a clear picture that the contribution of these workers, they are the one that contributes to tax, any payment, wherever. They are depleting what we are doing from us. We are working for money. We are buying a house. When you're buying a house, you automatically bought the cement. You have bought the brick. You have bought these things. And this is turning all businesses around. And businesses pay tax. They pay all incentives to government, for government to provide services. For us as workers, we say that we must make sure we work hard for their rights, for their safety and health, in order for them to keep the economy also safe and healthy. That's the brightness of the workers there.
There have been allegations, though, that unions are more concerned with increased wages for current members because there's percentages at play with regards to fees and membership fees and so forth. And it is sometimes leveled against unions that in trying to lobby for workers' rights, in many cases it's unions trying also to lobby for political power or for membership. Give us an idea, as an umbrella body, how do you guys go about working with organized business and or other major employers to work together to try and address some of these issues? That it's not always confrontational. There's got to be some collaboration, right?
It's a lesson that we all learn. We have been working separately, employers on their own, workers on their own, government on their own, and we have failed each other. We have failed the nation. We have failed the companies. Some of the companies get bankrupt because of that. So if you want to create an environment that is workable, you bring these three people together. Now that we are together as tripartite partners, we see each other's problem, we hear each other's problem, we solve each other's problem together for the best of the economy of this country, to grow the economy or to grow the industry where growth is needed. And also to manage labor unrest in a country that will not even scare investors. If labor unrest is managed in the country, you don't scare investors in this country.
Absolutely.
That's the biggest purpose and that's the good of it.
And where does that happen at the moment? Is there a formal structure where government, organized labor, and organized commerce come together? Are there any kind of regular engagements that happen at the moment?
Yes, we do have tripartite arrangement in the country, employers, federations, trade union federation, and government. We have recognized each other. We form a very strong body together, and we work together. And give you an example, when COVID came, we did not just say companies must just pay. We were thinking about how the company is going to survive throughout this. And we were positive and we were on the side of the companies. We have to convince our workers to make sure that they must surrender the bonuses, they must surrender the increments. Some of them have surrendered even their own salaries to say, take 10% of my salary, take 20% of my salary. If we could have not done that, it could have been a total collapse of the economy.
Yeah.
So it tells you the collaborations there has a meaning.
All right, brilliant. Job, we're nearly out of time. It's fascinating talking to you, and it's wonderful hearing your thoughts. Perhaps just in closing, you've mentioned education. Education is a big, slow wheel. It takes nearly two generations to change educational outcomes. Government policy is perhaps a little bit quicker, but equally slow. And from the union's perspective, what is something that we could enact in the next 6 to 12 months, or a project that perhaps you're working on, or a physical, tangible, practical thing that could be done to really tackle this issue of youth unemployment?
The biggest issue is the informal economy. I am not interested in formalizing the informal economy. I am interested in building a very conducive environment for informal economy to flourish properly and make business and grow and become formal through the growth. The issue of trying to see how we can stagnate them, how we can make them pay taxes and all those things is going to scare the employment of this, because the biggest, whether you like it or not, the biggest employment in this country, Elias, is in the informal economy, more than 50% in the informal economy. If we are not careful and we are trying to stagnate the informal economy, we are going to sit with a very high number of unemployment in this country. That is an automatic seat. You are planting a seat for civil war, okay, and that we cannot, all of us will not afford. Secondly, is the issue of unnecessary plans to exploit and drain any blue sand of these things. I had government wants to put in toll gates and all things on the road. And you see the licenses for a single car is almost over 1,000 per year. Trucks are paying road levies and the trucks must go every year to test for a test. Government must stop those plans with those things. If they do that, they will find it very hard, even for political support from the members of the public. They will be definitely in an uproar in that. So we must be careful. They must address the issue of youth employment and stop draining the already employed people, because they are in a very minimal number and they cannot carry the burden of the whole country alone. So I wish government will take advices from experienced people, make sure that first of all, this country must have food security plans in actions. If you don't plan for food security in this country, a hungry man is not a happy man.
Okay.
Thank you.
Job, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for your thoughts. That is the Secretary General of the National Union of Namibian Workers, Job Muniaru, sharing his thoughts on the scourge of unemployment.
This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 103.5.
We're joined now by Chief Empathy Officer and founder of Unchained People and Change, Monique Landman-Wervenkamp from the Netherlands, who will talk to us about unemployment from a leadership perspective. Hi, Monique. As Chief Empathy Officer, how do you look at unemployment from a leadership perspective?
Yeah, hi, Gary. Thank you for having me on the show again. My first spontaneous response is that unemployment is not only a job problem. And I look at it as a problem from, it's about people, it's about human dignity, it's about loss, and it's a societal and social problem. And for business leaders in finding solutions and contributing to solving this or adding a solution to this problem, that they should definitely take this in consideration too. Looking at a huge problem in society, adding that human perspective, that human angle definitely helps solving the problem.
What advice would you give business leaders? What can they do better?
Gary, what I really believe is that, first of all, before a board decides to retrench people, to let people go, I think that leaders must ask themselves, is this really the last resort? Is there maybe another way to save cost for now? Have we done everything to prevent this? Because it's heartbreaking. Because if you let your best people go in quieter times or when things fall short, they won't be there when your clients need them when they come back. And not only that, but if you fight for your people, the loyalty in the long term, which you will gain from fighting for them, might bring even more revenue in the long run and success. Another thing is, if you have to let them go, look at your process. If you can't change the outcome, if you can't change the message, make sure that you bring the message with so much respect and dignity. As a leader, show them that you care. I organized many, many of these processes where people had to let go and town hall meetings. And I saw the impact when you put effort in empathy, in a careful process with a human dignity, with feelings, with compassion, that it helps them in the grief process. And one of the great examples last year was with Airbnb during COVID, and the CEO wrote this beautiful, heartfelt letter. It was a heartbreaking letter because he had to let go a lot of staff, but he used words like, "I'm sorry, I know it's not your fault." He spent time in about the people who are staying, because you never underestimate how heartbreaking it is for those who are staying in a company, because they feel guilty that they have a job. They're happy that they have a job, but they also have to let go of their and miss their team. What you do in the process is, if you can't change it, make sure that with care and compassion, the communication, it definitely gives people a sense of dignity.
What is the impact on people being unemployed?
The impact on losing your job, and everyone who's ever gone through such an experience will share the same thing, is that what happens, they feel shame, they can have feelings of not being good enough. It is really a traumatic experience. And even if it's for purely economical reasons, and one can understand why it's happened, and one can reason it and even have understanding for it, the feeling of being let go is extremely traumatic, and it undermines confidence. And the impact is not only on personal feelings of confidence and on character, but it has a negative impact on mental health. It also has a negative impact on physical health, because people often, when they don't have the job anymore and they're unemployed, they can't spend money on gym memberships, etc. And the stress will obviously take a toll on the body, but also on society and economical levels. The impact is that people, marriages will break up, there's more divorce, people who are unemployed often feel not inspired and energized enough to do community service or to impact economically by spending the money. So it's not only on us as human beings and getting over the trauma, but also on friendship. And often all these feelings and these situations often leading to social isolation because of feelings of shame. And I think an unemployment problem, as you've been discussing tonight, is it has so many different angles. And I think that one of the things that I would definitely recommend for leaders is also hiring differently, and hiring for heart, hiring talent and for the right attitude, and train skills, because the skill is easily trained, but we have to relook at how we interview people and make people more equipped for the job, looking through a resume with a different lens and seeing the person behind it with the richness. And often there is judgment on a gap on a CV. But imagine if someone went through this heartbreaking process of losing a job, not their choice. It's also richness, and it's also an experience that they have undergone, an experience that also builds character. So maybe they contribute with so much richness from that experience, that being more resilient and creative, and maybe they've learned new skills or new knowledge to steam up for a new career. Now you suddenly have an opportunity to hire somebody who comes from a different industry, but imagine what the value they add. So looking at people with experience, with different experience, not from a judgmental way, but more from a diverse way, and to have different questions in interview sessions and look at resumes more at the human, besides the necessary skills that you need, of course. But if you hire for attitude and hire for character, train the skills and get different people with different experiences to a job, and that's going to make so much color and creating new jobs and giving them an opportunity to shine, and maybe they'd be your best hire in years.
That's Monique Landman-Bovenkamp giving us insights on leadership and unemployment from Unchained People and Change.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 1035.
I'm Angie Scholes with your weekly economics wrap. The Namibian Ministry of Mines and Energy announced this week that the price of petrol stays unchanged for November, but diesel goes up by $1.98 per litre. Cyrus Capital economist Robert McGregor.
Global oil prices have been a lot more volatile in recent terms. This is partially driven by the anticipated effect of Europe's ban on Russian oil coming into the market later this year and the impact that that will have on global supply, as well as OPEC looking to cut production in order to raise prices globally as well. In addition to that, the US dollar has been exerting quite a bit of strength, which has driven much weaker rand over recent weeks. This suggests that we may see some further price pressure in the coming weeks. At this stage, it doesn't seem certain that these pressures will alleviate, but over the longer term, they are expected to alleviate.
The Namibia Statistics Agency released the results of the 2019-2021 census mapping, which are the findings of the census mapping exercise undertaken between October 2019 and February 2021 by the NSA. The mapping exercise shows that there were 507,249 dwelling units in Namibia, of which 36.6% were detached houses, while a significant proportion of about 25% were improvised housing units. Salomo Hay, the NSA board chair. Person.
One of the most interesting results in terms of the energy sources and their functionalities or what energy sources are being used for, we were able to find that almost 60% of people in the rural areas use their phone as lighting. So what it tells you is that we're still far off in trying to really be in a position to electrify the majority of our people. It's also important to understand that this census mapping basic report gives us how far we have come in terms of the social contract that we have for the Namibian people. We're able to understand and measure the impact of the National Development Plan and subsequently the Harambe Prosperity Plan.
The Road Fund Administration will soon be introducing toll gates along 23 road sections in Namibia. The CEO of the Road Fund Administration has urged the public to remain calm amid these plans. UNAM Economics lecturer Omukakuyaha Mutunda weighs in.
Is something that should not even be considered at all. Namibians are taxed to the bone, with a population so heavily taxed and struggling to make ends meet. If you, let's say, for instance, put an e-toll between here and Rehoboth, here in Okahandja, and those people are coming every morning in and out, the public transport, they are going to demand to increase that. It is going to affect them. You don't start punishing an economy or people that is already and you're trying to starve them more.
Financial risks, including currency depreciation and inflation, are topping the list of challenges facing the 54 African countries in the year ahead. That's according to a new survey of the continent's leading insurance professionals conducted by the Pan-African reinsurer Continental Reinsurance. The survey found that depreciation and inflation are impacting business results and fueling fears of dampened growth over the next 12 months. Britain's energy price cap for consumers and government-funded discounts on bills for businesses will push official measures of inflation lower, the country's statistics office said on Monday. Reuters reports that the Office of the National Statistics said the energy price guarantee for household and the energy bill relief scheme for businesses would lower the unit prices of energy that fed into inflation indexes. Annual CPI inflation returned to a 40-year high of 10.1% in September, and the Bank of England expects it will peak at just below 11% this month. The U.S. Federal Reserve has raised interest rates by another 0.75% to try and tame inflation. It's the fourth consecutive meeting at which America's central bankers have opted for a 75 basis point hike. And finally, at the recently held Africa Tourism Leadership Forum in Gaborone, Botswana, it was mentioned that on average of each $100,000 spent on a vacation by a tourist from a developed country, only around $5 actually stays in the developing country's destination's economy. Local economist Arnie Charonda says that despite this, tourism still generates large sums of revenue.
You go to a place as an investor where there's everything, such as BIPA, where you can register your business and NAMRA, where you can get do your taxes and etc. indicates that such initiative shows that Namibia is a country that that will ensure the certainty that it's easy to do business in our country. So tourists can ultimately be potential investors, meaning that there will be more foreign direct investment into the country that can be put in good using and be circulated around the Namibian economy.
The Business Report.
Another packed show. Unemployment, it's clear that it's an enormous problem that weighs down on civil society. It weighs down on our economy and has all sorts of undesirable effects. Depression, violence, crime, suicide even. It's something we could be doing something about and should be. And hopefully you took some insights from this evening's show, jam-packed with thought leaders here in Namibia. And that's what we try and do here on The Business Report, is bring you the smartest business reporting. Thank you for making us Namibia's leading radio business show. You can catch us on our website, nova.com.na, if you heard something and want to hear more, or wherever you catch your podcasts. Now on either Apple or Android devices, you can go to your apps, your podcast store, and you'll find The Business Report hiding in there, this episode and all of our previous episodes. Thanks, as always, to our team, Angie Schultz, David Bishop, for putting the shows together, Raymond Ziefeld for making it sound good, to our guests for joining us and offering their wisdom and insight, and, of course, to you, the listener, for making sure that we continue to bring enlightenment and information to the Namibian public. That's it for this week's Business Report. You can catch us next week, same time, same place, and, of course, on the interwebs. Have a wonderful weekend.
That was The Business Report on Nova 1035. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Strubel and produced by Angie Schultz and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.